Hello, I'm at the British Council Global Citizenship Forum in Croydon. And it's been fascinating so far. The keynote, or what passed for a keynote, was by a gentleman I know sat talking to called Simon Anholt. Simon, hello.
Hello.
You started out by saying that you'd not really come across the concept of global citizenship before as a term in and of itself.
Yes, the first time I heard it was when they asked me to come and give this keynote, which made me think that perhaps it was all a nasty trick to make me uncomfortable. But it's quite an interesting concept. I'm just a little bit worried that maybe it isn't a real subject at all. It's one of those things you can talk about endlessly, but in fact it's the subject of everything.
My experience has been that actually that for conferences that's actually not a bad place to start, because rather than having a closed start point and therefore a predictable ending, you actually throw it wide open by giving people a topic that's so utterly nebulous. It's basically a framework for a much wider conversation.
Yeah, but haven't they got anything better to do?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose that they might come to the end of it and go, well, that was a waste of 3 days. Perhaps we should have spent it feeding the hungry or something. I don't know.
Yes. I mean, look, it's a very, very interesting subject. There's no question about it. And whether you call it global citizenship or global governance or making the world work better, the fact that we're here, the fact that we're talking about it, the fact that these distinguished people are here from every corner of the earth to talk very earnestly about it, it certainly suggests that there's a current here, that there's something that people are concerned about. What they're concerned about is the fact that governments aren't dealing with things, multinational institutions aren't dealing with things. You've got this gigantic force of 8 billion people, or is it 7 billion people, who might be able to achieve change if they work together. How are we going to make them do that? And the answer is you probably can't make them do that, but it's still an interesting conversation to have.
Your work as a policy advisor with governments seems to lead you to be mulching enormous amounts of data about what people actually do. Rather than making wild predictions about what people might do, you look at what they actually do. Would that be a fair assessment?
I look at what they actually think rather than what they know.
Okay.
Because the survey, which I've been doing since 2005, is a thing called the Nation Brands Index. What it does is it measures people's ignorance about countries. And ignorance is really the only word for it, because when I started doing it, I was hoping I'd find out all kinds of prejudices and cliches and commonplaces that people have about other countries. And what I actually discovered is that they hardly think anything about other countries at all. There's a little bit of cliche there, a little bit of prejudice, an enormous amount of prejudice, but really not very much of anything. And the reality is that people seldom think about other countries at all. It seems bizarre, but they really don't.
You raised an interesting point about the overinflated position of the United States in terms of people's consciousness of the other when thinking about other nations. But you also said that for most people there was one other place that they would think about. There were roughly three. Where they're from, a place they've been on holiday, a place where a family member is, and the US.
Yeah.
I'm interested in how you slice that data up, because as an individual you look at it and go, well, that's three out of 200 and odd nations on the planet. That's not very good.
Yeah.
Collectively it's still three per person, so you're still looking at 1.5% of the countries being represented per person. But actually within any group of 500-600 people you're going to have a fair cross section represented. How do we get people talking about those things? How do we? Your talk was a very interesting mixture of pragmatism, fatalism, and a kind of a vague hope that people as individuals do remarkable things, even if collectively we look at them and they go, you behave like 6-year-olds. What do we do?
The thing I perhaps didn't talk about enough is the hopefulness and the morality of youth. One of the other things that my survey has shown me is that young people are much more moral than old people. And that's a tremendous force. And one of the things that I try to do is to leverage that force against governments in order to persuade them that it is in their best interest to behave more morally in foreign and domestic policy. And what I say to them is, these young people out there who are today and in the future your customers for your exports, your tourists, your investors, they are the last remaining superpower on the planet. They are international public opinion. You should care about them more than anything else in the world. they will only respect you if you are good. Morality, perceptions of morality are the strongest predictor of overall national reputation. If you're regarded as being small and ugly, that's fine as long as you're good. If you're good, people love you. And that's because the majority of the people I'm asking are somewhat young. And that, to me, is a very exciting discovery. Because it means that I've got an argument to go to governments with. I can say to them, look, every time you declare war on your neighbour, you are eroding a part of your ability to make money. And it's a pretty straightforward connection. It's just a three-stage argument. You want to trade more because this is a globalised world and you depend on trade in order to get rich. You will not be able to trade profitably unless people regard you highly, unless you've got a good image. The only way to acquire a good image is by behaving more morally.
You put forward a fascinating idea, which was that you, whenever countries come to you to talk about their perception within the world, you ask them whether or not they're actually crap at being countries.
Yeah.
How does a job like yours work with the acknowledgement that nation states are kind of a fiction, that they're a weird construct that doesn't actually have anything to do with who we are? There was that beautiful example of the way that African tribesmen follow their cows across national boundaries because they're meaningless. When your entire sense of who you are is about herding animals, you follow the animals. How do you marry that sense of it being fictional bullshit against the enormous potential for you to do good by persuading a country to do something right?
Yeah. The imminent death of the nation state is constantly exaggerated. One of the many forces keeping the nation state alive and vigorous as a concept is the desire of the majority of the people on the planet to continue to believe in it.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons they want to continue to believe in it is because it's their only way of making sense of the world.
Yeah.
We live in a world in which, notwithstanding what I said before about people's ignorance about the rest of the world, nonetheless, we are presented daily more and more with more and more facts to digest, information to process about these other 204 countries and the people who live in them. We are faced with global challenges that have nothing to do with us domestically but affect us very personally. And people have to navigate through the complexity of that extraordinarily difficult concept. The only way they can do it is with these facile building blocks called nation states. The Americans are big, fat, ugly bullies. The French are very sophisticated and rather rude. The Japanese are incredibly clever at miniaturization. The British are posh and used to have an empire. I mean, this is the level. And when I say that international public opinion is the world's remaining superpower and it has a mental age of 6, I'm not kidding. That is collectively how smart we actually are. We're literally at that level. And that's quite a frightening prospect for most politicians because, you know, they're having to deal with a very powerful child.
Which I guess brings us back to the power of the individual and the fact that remarkable people can do remarkable things outside of that, and they buck trends. There's a line in a Bruce Coburn song where he says, "I never had a lot of faith in human beings, but sometimes they manage to shine."
Yes.
And you must see people shining all the time.
Yeah. You see, that's one of the slight scepticisms I have about groups like this, because so often the conversation is about how can we, a group of clever, engaged elites, create large effects. And the reality is I've never seen a group like this create a large effect. Deliberately creating large effects, unless you've got your finger on the button of a nuclear bomb, is very, very hard indeed, because the human species is intrinsically, authentically, irreducibly conservative. We do not like change, and we avoid change at all possible costs. So the only time I've ever seen large change take place is as a result of soft power, inspiration. Somebody somewhere does something extraordinary. Other people hear about it, are captivated by it, and copy it. That's how large changes take place. So if we're really sitting here talking about how to perpetrate this large change, what we should be looking about is the power of example, not how we're going to make it happen, how we're going to create an institution that will compel people to be brothers, because that doesn't work. But what we can do is, if we can find a machine that identifies, stimulates, encourages, collects, and reproduces inspiring examples, if truly inspiring examples, and then makes them contagious, then you can achieve large change.
I mean, and that gives me incredible hope, because I see it happening on a small scale every day on the web. I see people looking at examples of of people's behaviour going, I want to be like that. That actually that modelling of small scale heroism, the was it Kierkegaard called the Knights of Faith? Yes. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
Yes.
But I see that happening all the time.
Yes.
And that we can affect large change by having a large number of people just stepping up and doing something remarkable and it being infectious.
Yes.
That gives me hope. Does it you?
Absolutely. It's the only reason I carry on.
Brilliant.
The beating of the butterfly's wings can create a typhoon on the other side of the ocean.
I think it's been very good having you here. I'm not that anyone gives a shit what I think about it, but I think it's been marvellous having you here. I hope that the provocation is received in the way that it was intended, and that actually it gives people pause to think why they're here and what they're doing and what more they can do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.